All right. So last time I was sort of filling in a gap, which is that I forgot to tell you how to describe random fields on a spherical sky. We covered the case of a 2D random field in a Euclidean plane. And there's sort of a dictionary that goes back and forth where every Euclidean object has a spherical moral equivalent, but the new special functions arise and the dictionary is not obvious. So a real space field function of a two variables, a two-component vector, would become, in the spherical case, a function of a unit three vector. I guess this one is obvious. In harmonic space, the Fourier transform of a Euclidean function is another function of two variables. In the spherical case, that becomes a sequence of coefficients, ALM, where the L and Ms are discrete integer indices. The power spectrum in the 2D Euclidean case is defined by this equation. This equation is both a theorem and a definition. It's the theorem part says that the right-hand side that I've written down is the most general form that's allowed by the symmetries, the translational and rotational symmetry of the 2D Euclidean plane. And this prefactor is a free function that's allowed by symmetry, and that's the definition of the power spectrum. The analogous statement in the spherical case is that when I correlate two ALMs, I get something. I get Kronecker deltas forcing the L and M to be equal. That's like this delta function forcing the wave numbers to be equal, and with a free coefficient that it can depend on L but not M. This is the famous power spectrum that's in all the plots of the CMB power spectrum, for example, but it's only defined at integer values of L. I believe the last thing that I'd written down was for a real field. Over here, we had the statement that pairs of wave numbers L and minus L are related to each other by complex conjugation. And in the spherical case, the positive and negative values of M are related to each other by complex conjugation. For m equals 0, this says that ALM is a real number. In the Euclidean case, we had some miscellaneous properties, which I wrote down quickly without definition. So for example, we had the, if you have a two-point correlator in, we had an identity that said that a two-point correlator in Fourier space without the star, in the Euclidean case, gives a delta function L plus L prime. And in the spherical case, you'll see why I want to derive these in a minute. I get the same thing. There's an analogous identity that says that I get a delta function between m and minus m prime and a sine minus 1 to the m. And this follows, as in the Euclidean case, this follows by combining the last two identities. The reason that I'm writing this down is it lets me unpack the two-point correlator into real and complex parts. That's really what I need to compute the Fisher the CMB Fisher matrix in a minute. So over here we had this identity.
Let's see over.
This is easy to show by, in the spherical case, by writing the real part as ALM plus ALM star over 2, expanding everything out and using the Fourier space expectation values we derived before. And similarly with a real part and imaginary part. You get 0 in both cases. I forgot a square here on the 2π. So my reason for unpacking the two-point function into its real and imaginary parts in Fourier space is just because I want to talk about how you would simulate a random field on the sphere, for example, make a simulated CMB map. In Fourier space, the covariance is diagonal. These formulas show that different L's are independent of each other. At a given value of L, the different M's are independent of each other. And at a given LM pair, the real parts and the imaginary parts of ALM are independent. So the covariance matrix of the ALMs unpacked into its real and complex parts is going to be a completely diagonal matrix. To be totally explicit about this, for each multipole L, there are 2L plus 1 real degrees of freedom. Real part of AL0. AL0 is real. And the remaining guys are complex. The negative m's, just to take the case of the CMB for concreteness, since it's a real valued field, the negative m's are given in terms of the positive m's by this identity. And if I view this as a vector of length 2L plus 1, then it's 2L plus 1 by 2L plus 1 covariance matrix is completely diagonal. And the identities show that there's one CL, and the remaining entries are CL over 2. So if I wanted to simulate a Gaussian random field on the computer, say the CMB, well, first I need to know the CLs, which would come by running one of these big software packages like CAMB or CLASS. And then what I would do is I would loop over all LM pairs out to some maximum L that would be set by the resolution at which I want the map. And then for each L, there are these 2L plus 1 numbers that I need to simulate. And I just populate them as independent Gaussian random variables. This guy is a Gaussian random number with variance CL, and the remaining guys are Gaussian random numbers with variance CL over 2. When I've generated all those independent Gaussian random numbers, I've simulated the map in harmonic space. I've computed its coefficients ALM, which are analogous to the phi L's in the Euclidean case. And if the real space representation of the field is preferred, if, for example, I want to stare at a map, then I would go from harmonic space to real space by computing this sum, where the YLMs are some special functions that can be computed efficiently on the computer. Okay. So this counting is really what I wanted to get at, but I thought it would be better to talk about the math of fields on the sphere somewhat systematically.
I had a question. How would you store these TNs in a Galois program?
How would you store the TNs? Oh, yeah. So there's a detail here, which is that you need to choose some pixelization of the sphere. For example, you could pixelize the sphere like an igloo. Or there are other pixelizations. The one that's almost always used, well, usually used, in for the CMB is something called the Heelpix pixelization, which is actually a mess to describe in detail, and it has the property that the pixels look like little diamonds. The pixelization is just giving you some finite set of n values where you evaluate this sum. Okay. So now I want to go back to the Fisher matrix, where I was talking about this general setup. The general setup is that I have some model space with parameters theta. And then if I have some values of the model parameters, I generate some data via some conditional probability distribution. And the Fisher matrix is defined very generally like this. Where the expectation value of a realizations of the data is taken in some preferred or fiducial model, where you you're doing the forecast for models that are near the fiducial model. And I want to use the Fisher matrix to answer the question, how well can the CMB power spectrum be measured? This question can be answered one L at a time. So I can apply the Fisher matrix in the case where there's only one parameter model space. And the data consists of 2 L plus 1 numbers. The ALMs at that particular value of L. An assumption here is that let's assume that the CMB sky is perfectly measured. That is, we've measured every ALM without any statistical error. In reality, a CMB experiment will have some detector noise, which adds statistical errors. And it's also the case that the CMB experiment can only observe a finite part of the sky. Even for a satellite, which can scan the whole sky, the data in the galactic plane will generally not be usable because the galaxy is bright, and you'll end up having to mask like 20% of the sky. All right. So we want to compute this Fisher matrix, and the first step is going to be writing down the conditional likelihood. And the reason that I wrote down this, worked through all of this and wrote down the covariance matrix is just so we could stare at that covariance matrix and write down the likelihood. Because the ALMs are independent, I wrote it backwards. I meant to write the likelihood, I wanted the conditional likelihood of the data given the model parameter, not the other way around, which would be the posterior likelihood. Okay. So given a value of CL, then the way that these numbers are generated is they're independent Gaussian random numbers. So I just want to write down the probability that that procedure generates a given sequence of values. And for that'll be a product of likelihoods for each of the m's. At m equals 0, the probability of getting a particular AL0 is given by the Gaussian PDF. So that's at m equals 0, I have a single real number. And it's a Gaussian random variable with variance CL. So its likelihood is given by this. That's just the usual formula for a Gaussian random probability distribution. And then I'm going to put in the likelihoods for the positive m's. Each of those will have a real part and an imaginary part. And just to be careful with the factors of 2, the real part is a Gaussian random variable with variance CL over 2, and likewise for the imaginary part. So that's the likelihood, and there's a way of writing it which is a little nicer. So I'm not going to keep track of the overall constant appearing in the likelihood, since that will go away in the Fisher matrix anyway. You just differentiate a constant and get 0. I will keep track of the overall power of CL. So I have a CL to the minus 1/2 here, and then 2L factors of CL to the minus 1/2. So pulling those out, I get CL to the minus 2L plus 1 over 2. And then I want to keep track of the exps. So these terms, of course, can be grouped together. This whole thing can be grouped together to look like the expectation value of the complex square over CL. And I have a factor of 2 at m equals 0 that I didn't have at positive L. But there's a nice way of writing it, which is to run the sum from negative L to L and write the result this way. It just so happens that at m equals 0, I get AL0 squared over 2CL, which is what I want. And then at the other m's, I have two factors, one from negative m and one from positive m, that combine to give me this term without the factor of 2. So that's just a little algebra trick that will make the result a little more compact. So now that I've written down, the conditional likelihood is not trivial to write down. It requires going through all of this sphere math and keeping track of factors of 2. Once it's written down, calculating the Fisher matrix is a fairly straightforward calculation. So I'm going to compute the one by one Fisher matrix in quotes. Here, the model parameter theta is CL, and the data that I'm averaging over are the ALMs, these two L plus one real numbers. Remember, this is for a single L in the CMB. So if I take the log of that expression, I get this. Let's put the minus sign on the outside. If I evaluate those derivatives, I get 2L1 over CL squared. In this step, I'll take the expectation value. When I take the expectation value of ALM squared, I get CL. So that gives this. No expectation value, no. We write the result as CL over CL cubed. And then this doesn't depend on M, so the sum just gives a factor of 2L plus 1. And there's a cancellation with this term. When I put in the overall sign, I get this. That's the answer. So what this shows is that the error bar on CL is the notation sigma of CL means the error bar in CL, is the square root of the variance. In general, the Fisher matrix is the inverse of the covariance matrix. In the one by one case, that just means the variance is 1 over F, which is the square root of 2 over 2L plus 1 times CL. And what we've derived here is, this one's box-worthy too. What we've derived here is what's called the cosmic variance error on the CMB power spectrum. If you look at plots of the CMB power spectrum with error bars on the individual Ls, you'll see that the fractional size of the error, that is the error relative to CL itself, is going down as 1 over square root L. Eventually they blow up, and I'll say why. When you get to high enough L, they blow up, and I'll say why that's true in a minute. And this error bar represents the ultimate limit on how well you can measure the CMB power spectrum if you've measured every mode on the sky, just because there are a finite number of modes to measure. So as a toy example, imagine that you're trying to estimate the variance of a Gaussian random variable, and you don't know it in advance, but you have some number of samples to work with. Then there's some error on the your estimate of the variance just due to the finite amount of data, and which goes down as, in this example, the error happens to be root 2 over n. And the same thing happens in the CMB. If I want to measure the quadrupole, say, then there are just five numbers, five modes on the sky, and once I've measured them, there's nothing else that I can measure. So this this problem of cosmic variance, and I say it's a problem because you can get stuck with weird features, features of borderline statistical significance, and there's no way to take more data. It happens to be the case that in RCMB, the quadrupole is low. You can see that, and the octupole, the O equals 3 mode, is a little low. The octupole is low at around 1 sigma, and the quadrupole is low at around 2 sigma. So it could be that the quadrupole is just low as a statistical fluke. There's like a 5% chance that if you imagine randomly restarting the initial conditions that generated RCMB, that you would get a quadrupole this low. Or another way of thinking about it is that if you imagine a bunch of observers distributed spatially throughout the universe, that all observe their CMB skies, then 5% of these observers, including us, will be scratching their heads wondering why the quadrupole is this low. So that's one explanation, is that it's just a statistical fluke. And then another explanation is, of course, it's very compelling to notice that on the largest scales of our universe, something interesting seems to be going on. And maybe that's a sign that we don't understand the physics completely. The problem is that either of those stories seems plausible. And in most fields of physics, you would just take more data. Like if you saw a few sigma anomaly in a particle physics experiment, you would just run the accelerator longer and shrink the error bar. We can't do that in cosmology. There's only one CMB sky we can ever measure. And this problem's actually kind of unique to cosmology. It's hard to think of another science that has this issue. All right. One more detail I want to mention here is that I'm just going to write this formula down. In a real experiment, the measurement is not cosmic variance limited. The experiment has some noise or statistical error when it measures the ALMs. And so a formula that you might see a lot is this, which accounts for, I won't define everything precisely, I'll just explain qualitatively how it works, which accounts for a sky fraction which is observed, which need not be equal to 1, and a noise power spectrum, if the ALMs are observed with some noise added on top of them, then that viewed as a field on the sphere, that noise will have a power spectrum. Now, what happens in a real experiment is that, and the details of how this is modeled depend on the details of the experiment. But what will always happen in a real CMB experiment is the noise starts out very small. The quadrupole is a very bright signal compared to the sensitivity of modern experiments. But these high Ls are weak. So at some point, the noise power spectrum will overtake the CMB power spectrum, and the signal will start to become buried in the noise. And then the error bars blow up. So they go down as 1 over root L. They go down with a cosmic variance error and start blowing up. So if you compare, for example, WMAP, which is a very famous satellite experiment, and Planck, a more recent experiment that superseded it, you'll see that WMAP becomes noise dominated. The difference between the experiments is that WMAP becomes noise dominated at ELVA around 500, and Planck becomes noise dominated at ELVA around 1500. The two experiments have exactly the same error bars at low L, and this, you know, the same pattern of which CLs look anomalously high and which CLs look anomalously low. There are other weird features. There's another dip at around L of 20, as you may have heard. In this range, between 500 and 1500, the Planck error bars are much smaller than the WMAP error bars. And then out here, both blow up. Okay. Now, I want to talk about, so that's the case. This is the whole story. If you are imagining assigning an independent error bar to every L, in other words, you're treating each CL as an independent parameter with no model that's linking the seals. But what if all the CLs are controlled by some smaller set of parameters, like the six-parameter standard cosmological model? I'll denote the parameters abstractly by theta A, but they're just the usual list. Or you might be interested in some extension of the standard model with more parameters. Those parameters would determine the CMB power spectrum, which determines the statistics of the ALMs. So another question we can answer with the Fisher matrix is, if we measure the ALMs, and I'll assume cosmic variance limited for now, that all the ALMs are measured perfectly up to some maximum multipole Lmax, then what are the parameter constraints on these cosmological parameters? Now, you could imagine having a black box, like the CAMB software or the CLASS software, that computes CL given a set of cosmological parameters. And I'll mention in advance that another thing which is going to appear in the Fisher matrix is the derivative of the CLs with respect to a cosmological parameter like omega baryon or H. And you can compute that just as a trick. And I mentioned this partly because it's going to come up in the homework. If you only have access to the black box that computes the power spectrum from parameters, and you want to know the derivative of the power spectrum, then one thing that you can do is run the black box twice. You just step the parameter and finite difference. My conscience won't let me write this equation down without, I should put approximately here. My conscience won't let me write this down without mentioning that a two-sided differentiation scheme is more numerically accurate. This is an approximation that becomes more accurate as the step size delta theta is taken to zero. However, for a real software package, there will also be some round-off error that will make the result numerically unstable if delta theta is taken too small. The most common way that numerical calculations are numerically unstable is because you are trying to compute a small quantity by differencing two things that are nearly equal, so that round-off errors in these two factors don't cancel and lead to a spuriously large result. So if I took delta theta to be very tiny, then because these computations will have independent round-off errors, this finite difference will become very susceptible to numerical noise. So there'll be, in practice, there's some like stable range of delta theta that you might need to find empirically. I'm just mentioning some of the practical pitfalls that can arise in these Fisher matrix calculations. With this setup, let's compute the Fisher matrix. So the first we want to write the conditional likelihood for the data given a set of cosmological parameters. And that is, previously we wrote down the likelihood for the ALMs at a single value of L given the value of CL. Here the likelihood will just be a product of each of those single L likelihoods. The product over L is understood to run up to L max. The right-hand side here is really a function of the thetas, because the CLs depend on theta. Now I'll calculate the Fisher matrix. Differentiating log p with respect to the model parameters and taking the expectation value over realizations of the data. This calculation is really similar to the previous one. So in this step, I've taken the log. Plug this in, I'm taking the log. Continuing. In this step, I'll compute the derivatives. When I differentiate with respect to theta, I just get first and second derivatives of the power spectrum. The second derivative terms will cancel, as you'll see in a minute. So if I just turn the Fisher matrix crank, this is what I end up with. Now, as in the previous calculation, I take the expectation value over the ALMs by just replacing this by CL. So if I replace ALM squared by CL, then this sum over M gives a factor of 2L plus 1. There are then some cancellations that take place, like this factor of with this term with the second derivative cancels against this one. And what you end up with is this. So this is a really general result. For the CMB or for any Gaussian field on the sphere, with any set of parameters controlling the power spectrum, this is the cosmic variance. This Fisher matrix gives you the cosmic variance limited errors on the parameters. CMB Fisher matrix. And it would be a 6x6 matrix, so the diagonals, or rather their square roots, would tell you the error on each parameter, and the off-diagonals would tell you how they're correlated. So if you wanted to do a forecast for a CMB experiment, then you would take one of these black boxes, evaluate the power spectrum and all the derivatives that you need numerically, and then plug into this format, into this formula. And then you have a complete description of the errors on parameters and how they covary with each other. And this is one of the homework problems and the longest one on the problem set that I'm about to post, doing this for a WMAP-like experiment. Just as a comment for a non-cosmic variance limited experiment. Well, two comments. One, I forgot to say that one little detail is that for a minor detail, is that for a real experiment, the cosmologically interesting owl start at L equals 2. That's because the L equals 0 mode, the monopole of the CMB, is just its average. That is to say, when you measure the temperature of the CMB, the CMB is some average temperature around 2.7 Kelvin plus some tiny fluctuations on the order of, say, 100 microkelvin. So the monopole is just this. That's what I get if I just average over the CMB temperature field over the whole sky without looking at its anisotropy. So the monopole contains information. It measures the CMB temperature, which is equivalent, if you want, to the radiation density or omega radiation h squared. It's just not part of the fluctuations that are being controlled by the CMB power spectrum. It's part of the background. The dipole, well, in principle, the dipole contains cosmological information. It's just that, and we could use it if we knew what our velocity was in the cosmic rest frame. But we have some velocity on top of the, we're not a co-moving observer, we have some velocity in the cosmic rest frame. And that shows up as a dipole which adds to and is degenerate with the so-called cosmological dipole. So the dipole modes really tell us, and it's much larger, the dipole is like 3 millikelvin. The L equals 1 modes are like 3 millikelvin. So the monopole is 3 Kelvin and measures the background. The dipole is 3 millikelvin and measures our velocity. And the higher modes are hundreds of microkelvin, or around 100 microkelvin, and measure cosmological parameters. That's just the detail. Final comment is that for a non-cosmic variance limited experiment, you would put a F sky in front. And put in a noise power spectrum here. Because the noise power spectrum blows up at high L, this sum will converge for a realistic experiment. You can just run the sum out to L equals infinity. For a cosmic variance limited experiment, you have to assume an L max because you're just assuming that you keep increasing the information content as you measure more and more ALMs. Okay. So this is some practical examples of how we use the Fisher matrix to forecast error bars on things, or covariance in addition to error bars. Now I just want to, I'm almost done talking about stats. I just want to conclude with talking about, I thought I could squeeze this into the lecture today, but it'll probably take about half an hour and I have about 15 minutes. I want to talk about some abstract properties of the Fisher matrix.
Is that F sky in the numerator here?
That's true for the Fisher matrix. The inverse of the Fisher matrix is the covariance. Over here the, I'm sorry, I have it wrong over here. Thanks. So the F sky should have been here before. The F sky is in the numerator in the Fisher matrix, and then it ends up in the denominator when I invert the Fisher matrix. As the sky fraction decreases, the error bars get bigger. I want to think about a general setup where I have some space of model parameters that statistically determine some data. And the Fisher matrix will forecast the inverse covariance matrix, which lets me draw error ellipses in the parameter space. So here's a general property of the Fisher matrix. If the data set D is the consists of two independent parts, D equals D1 plus D2. Then, in other words, if I can think of my experiment as two independent sub-experiments, then the Fisher matrices add. So you could think of the Fisher matrix as something that accumulates as you add independent information. Sometimes it's called the Fisher information matrix. You could see this property sneaking in if you look at the details of some of our formulas, like to take this one. Because I can view a CMB experiment as an independent experiment for every L. It's just a property of the ALMs that they're independent of each other. And so the Fisher matrix has to have this form with an outer sum over L, where the quantity being summed is the Fisher matrix you would have in an artificial situation where you measure the ALMs only at one specific value of L. The factor of 2L plus 1 here is because the different M's are independent at a particular level. So this is easy to show from the definition. So well, I didn't precisely define what the hypothesis means. Independent means that the probability of getting data D1, D2 is the product of some independent PDFs telling me the probability of getting D1 and then the probability of getting D2. These are conditional probabilities assuming a particular model. The proof is, starting from this, is straightforward given the definition of the Fisher matrix. If this conditional probability is the product of two factors, then this would split as the log. The log would be a sum. Now, let me take this expectation value over realizations of the data D1, D2. In this term, there's no D2 dependence, and in this term, there's no D1 dependence. So I can write this term just as an expectation value over D1. The expectation value over D2 is superfluous. And likewise over here. And then this is F1 and F2. So you might be you might use this formula, for example, if you're if you were the director of a large funding agency. Say you've funded a bunch of experiments that are going to occupy the next 5 years, and you're thinking about what to fund next. You might get a picture of what cosmology will look like after 5 years from now by taking all the experiments that you've already funded and just adding up their Fisher matrix. And then if you want to know how much information some hypothetical new experiment would add, you would just add it in and plot the error ellipses and decide how happy you are. And this is more or less what's done, except that it's not a centralized forecasting effort. It's a decentralized community-wide effort. This is just a very common type of paper where you have some, there's new experiment that everyone's thinking about, and you include it and with some other experiments and look at forecasts and different interesting extensions of the standard cosmological model. So I have a few more general properties, but the next one's going to take more than 5 minutes, and I don't want to stop in the middle of a calculation. So why don't I stop there for today and finish talking about the Fisher matrix next time?